Don't let them silence us.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
Welcome to the Rape Declaration Forum radio program. RDF is a monthly live call-in show, and for the past 10 years provides a virtual safe space for survivors of rape, sexual and domestic abuse to share their stories, struggles, and triumphs. These topics are uncomfortable, but it's our mission to break the silence and create a platform of awareness, compassion, and empowerment. I am your grateful host, rape survivor, holistic integrated counselor, Reverend J. Grace. If you would like to get in touch with us, go to facebook.com/RDF Radio, or you can go to my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/J Grace. That's J-A-Y-G-R-A-Y-C-E. As always, the views and opinions expressed on RDF Radio program, as well as by the guest producers, hosts, or co-hosts, and call-in listeners, are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of WBAI, the B, or its affiliates. Listener's discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. It is Jay Grace, your host for Rape Declaration Forum here on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. Thank you for spending this hour with us. Today, we have two guests. We have Angela Smith. She is a co-founder and national coordinator of HEAL, and her website is heal-online.org. Correct, Angela?
Yes.
Okay, just yes, making sure. Making sure. And of course,
it's H-E-A-L, not H-E-E-L.
Okay, good. Yes, exactly. And with us, of course, we have our second guest. She's a very inspiring survivor, acclaimed author, poet, activist, and contributor to Luna Luna magazine and various journals. Welcome back to the show, Emma Eden Ramos.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. And welcome everyone to the program. I mentioned before that you were on the show, Emma, and you were so courageous in sharing your story and your passion and dedication to helping survivors is something that I highly, highly am so respectful to you for doing. And so I thank you for doing that.
No, thank you for giving me a platform.
You know, I wish we didn't have to have this platform, but I'm very grateful that we do have it. Emma Eden, I love that name, by the way.
Thank you.
You reached out to me last week, and we've been touching base little by little, but you were really upset by some things that you learned. And I want you to, in your own words, share what inspired you to want to be on the show again.
Yeah. So, you know, I was at a treatment center or a residential treatment center, RTC, in Utah in 2005. I was there for 9 months. I was 17. I ended up signing myself out at 18. And, I mean, when I was there, there were some... It was a traumatic experience. One of those experiences that I feel like it's taken me over 10 years to really be able to process fully. And, you know, I started thinking about my experience there, you know, again recently, because I learned that one of the therapists who worked with us, I mean, did... you know, trauma survivor groups with us. You know, a man who had me hug him numerous times when, you know, I made it pretty clear that I felt really uncomfortable. But, you know, if you said no to something like that, you would be considered, you know, obstinate or misbehaving. Mm-hmm. So this man who I always felt very uncomfortable around, who, you know, specialized in treating teenagers with PTSD, was accused in 2013 of 4 counts of rape. And so I found that, you know, somebody sent me the information, and I was not shocked because not shocked that it was him, but just shocked that he would have been able to get away with it, and right. especially shocked when I found out that he's actually still practicing in a different treatment center, but a treatment center where he works one-on-one with women who've been, you know, victims of sexual assault. And so, you know, that sort of was what made me start to think about my experience again, reach out to some of the other girls I was at New Haven with and see what their experiences were like. And it just sort of started coming back after, you know, learning about this gentleman's record.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, first of all, it sounds awful. And Angela, I'm going to have you in the conversation. Just listening to what Emma, because I know Emma has reached out to you via email in the past about this particular situation and the work that you do at HEAL, how do you help people such as Emma?
There's a few different ways. We really encourage victims to report the abuse and report anything. If there's forced touching, that should be a complaint to the licensing board. For any professionals who are doing anything that makes their clients uncomfortable, really, or that puts them in a dangerous situation. Any complaints need to be filed with the proper authorities. HEAL receives a lot of complaints. Unfortunately, a lot of survivors are too ashamed or embarrassed or afraid. Often it's just fear. It's fear coming out in these other ways. They're afraid of repercussions. They don't want the abusers in institutional settings or any other setting, but I focus on institutional settings, to know that they filed a complaint because they fear that that person will retaliate against them in some way. It's really difficult for teens if they're still under the control or guidance or whatever you want to call it of their parents. Because if they report it, these programs like New Haven will tell parents, if your child says anything bad about the program, that is a sign that they're backsliding and they need to be sent back. Right. So as soon as Emma was to report to her parents, even when she was underage, that these things were going on and she was uncomfortable, doing that is a risk of being returned to your abuser. I'm about to cry because it's such a horrific thing for kids to have to go through.
Absolutely. I'm terrified just hearing it, and I'm appalled that this man is still doing, quote-unquote, his job and running away with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, the things that I remember, you know, when I was at New Haven, I mean, it's absolutely true, you know, what Angela said, that when you're in an RTC, you know, and things are happening and you are, you know, experiencing abuse or, you know, members of the staff are saying inappropriate things or, you know, doing things to you that you know they shouldn't be allowed to do, you can't tell your parents, because the moment you do, they'll, you know, in New Haven, they have a level system. So the very bottom level, what they call the safety level, you're not allowed to have any conversation or any contact, verbal contact with your family unless a therapist is listening in. On the other levels, you can only talk to your family or anybody outside of New Haven if a staff member is listening in. So in the end, you really, you don't have the ability to speak, you know, privately with your family and say, you know, this is happening and it's making me uncomfortable, because either somebody's listening in or, you know, if you are lucky and you can pull your, you know, parent aside during, you know, parent weekend and they bring it up with the staff or the treatment team, what they end up hearing is, well, you know, this isn't happening, or she's just saying whatever she's saying so that she can so that, you know, she can go home and start using again or start doing whatever it was that she was doing that brought her to New Haven in the first place.
Well, that
so
puts,
in the end, you just,
it just puts, basically, you're relinquishing your rights when you go into these type of treatment centers, it sounds like, especially if you're a young adult. And of course, parents and people who care about, you know, someone that's suffering, they just want them to get better. So they're going to entrust their children to these facilities, these treatment centers. And what can parents do before they even get to that point to ensure, or is there nothing they can do about that once they're in the treatment center?
Right. Well, parents get threatened. I mean, this is an amazing development that I've learned in my years of advocacy is one woman, her ex-husband got emergency custody of their son and sent him to a facility in Virginia. And then what happened was she had full custody, okay? This is a custody dispute situation, but she had full custody and legal guardianship of her son. She went to pick him up after school like normal at 3 o'clock. Oh, well, he left with his father. Oh. What? Excuse me? He left with his father? Well, yeah, he had custody papers. Well, he had gone in and got an emergency custody order, which is a way of going around having to actually see the other party in court. You can go to a judge and say, look, I think my kid's in danger. I want emergency custody. And her ex-husband was a prominent lawyer and very an insider to the court system. So he was able to pull this trick to do this. He sent their son to a facility in Virginia. And then when she finally figured out where her son was, she went to that facility, and they said, oh, well, he's been transferred to a facility in Utah. And so then she had to spend months trying to find out what facility in Utah he'd been transferred to, because they would not give her the information, even though she was legally allowed to have it. So there's that legal maneuvering. She finally finds out what facility he's in Utah, goes to Utah, planning to at least visit him, if not remove him from the facility. And the facility gives her all of his paperwork, says it's too late in the day for a visit. Please come back in the morning during normal business hours. I guess it was in the evening when she showed up. And they said, please come back, you know, in the morning. You can't. It would disrupt his treatment, whatever, to have him have a visit from his mother at this hour. So please come back tomorrow. But in the meantime, we're going to give you all of his documents so you can understand why he's here and what his treatment looks like. And so they gave her a copy of all these documents. As soon as she left the facility, the program called the police and said she had stolen confidential documents from the facility.
Oh,
they had
gosh.
Her arrested, and they held her for 24 hours in lockup. Yeah.
Wow, that is insane.
Then, yeah. So that's not the only situation where that's happened to parents. Parents don't realize that basically what I think of this industry is that it's organized crime, that most of it is organized crime masquerading as treatment facilities for youth. I'm not saying all treatment providers are organized crime. I'm saying there's a lot of organized crime involved in this industry.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't the only situation. I had another parent tell me that a program director in Washington State, at a facility in Washington State, took a swing at her when she was questioning their treatment practices, like actually took a physical punch swing
at the
mother.
Wow.
And that they were Native American, American Indian, and I feel like a lot of these programs are training camps, certainly the ones in Idaho and Montana, and they are, I don't know, I've referred to them as like Hitler youth camps sometimes, but that's because they are, there's a lot of things I could go into that's like a really dark side of this industry, which I will try not to go too far into it. I'll just say what happened to another parent. Another parent, it was a situation where they actually had legal custody and guardianship, and they had sent their two children. It was a mother and stepfather. They sent their two children to go visit their biological father in another state. Mm-hmm. The biological father said that the mother had abandoned the children with him, and it was just a scheduled visitation. But he went to the court in his state and said his children had been abandoned with him, and he wanted emergency custody. He used that illegally obtained emergency custody order mm-hmm. to send his children to facilities in Utah. Now, when the rightful legal guardians finally found out where the kids were and went to Utah to remove them and bring them home, this was after 13 months later, by the way. That's how long it took them to find out what facilities they were being held at in Utah.
What a nightmare.
Yeah, they finally got there, and at one of the facilities, when they went to pick up their daughter, I think, because they had a son and daughter, they went to pick up the girl mm-hmm. at one of the facilities, and the facility said, "You look publicly drunk. I'm going to contact law enforcement and let them know that you're inebriated and that they should come pick you up." So they were threatening the parents to have them arrested. The mother stayed inside. The stepfather went outside and called me and was like, "What do we do mm-hmm. in this situation? They're threatening to have us arrested. I'm as sober as a church mouse. I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. They're threatening us. I don't know how should I handle the situation?" And I said, "Well, you tell them. I said, you're going to call me back if this doesn't work, okay? And mm-hmm. I will have the number for the local FBI for you at that moment. Mm-hmm. But you're going to walk back in there, and you're going to tell them that you are going to have them charged with conspiracy to commit kidnapping.
Yeah, key word.
If you don't release your daughter immediately, you know, that you're the rightful legal guardian. Mm-hmm. They have no right that they've participated in an illegal kidnapping scheme with the biological father. He did not have the legal right to do so at this point. They're withholding your child, and they're guilty of kidnapping, and you're going to press federal charges if they don't release her right now." Okay. And so they went back in and said that, and then I didn't hear anything for about an hour, and I was really, really worried.
I was like,
"Oh, no, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And then they called me and said, "We're on the road. We've got both kids,
It
worked." And it was like, "Oh, thank God." But
Wow, that's great.
They were like, "That's crazy." Yeah, it's crazy.
It's really insane. I mean, I know what Emma has shared with me in the past, and just doing research for this program, I realized that a lot of the complaints come from Utah. I noticed that for some reason.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it's a state that they have very poor child laws or mm-hmm. child protection laws. Mm-hmm. So, and why that is, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think a number of states in the Midwest similar in terms of their laws about, you know, what you can do to children, what mm-hmm. is abuse, what isn't abuse. But I do know it's relatively lax in Utah, which is one of the reasons why I think there are so many treatment centers in Utah, because there are a number of RTCs
mm-hmm,
that are like, or wilderness center or wilderness treatment programs, which, you know, basically programs where teenagers live out in the wilderness, you know, whether it's in the middle of February, freezing cold, you know, kids die sometimes. I mean, it's, you know, you're yeah. living outside by yourself, fending for yourself, essentially, mm-hmm. and that's supposed to be therapeutic. Or, you know, these other RTCs, like New Haven,
mm-hmm.
That are, I mean, so I think just the poor child laws, mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. I also do think that there is a religious connection. I mean, I know that at least in the case of New Haven,
mm-hmm.
New Haven is not technically a Mormon organization. It isn't a Mormon treatment center.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, we, you know, those of us, the girls who were there, I mean, we all lived under Mormon rule. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody who worked there was Mormon. You know, we were constantly hearing about the Mormon doctrine, constantly hearing things like homosexuality is evil, which for me was difficult because, you know, I was just coming to terms with my own sexuality, you know, when I was 17
mm-hmm.
and when I went to Utah. And so, you know, I was coming from a place of trying to hold, or trying to attain self-acceptance.
Right.
And, you know, I went into the center in Utah where staff would openly say, you know, homos are, and use words like that. You know, they would say, oh, homos are dirty, or, you know, blah, like just really offensive things.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, at one point I remember I'd probably been there maybe 2 months when I came out, you know, to one of the other girls,
mm-hmm.
You know, one evening, I just said, oh, you know, I'm gay. And after that, I wasn't allowed to be alone with any of the other girls without a staff
mm.
in the room. And towards the end of my stay there, yeah, I mean, they had rules that no girl could be allowed alone with Emma because, you know, she might do something.
Oh, so sorry.
Yeah. So stuff like, I mean, and I, you know, I think that I've read a number of, posts by other, you know, young men and young women, you know, young gay men, young mm-hmm. gay women who have had similar experiences
mm-hmm.
at treatment centers in Utah, you know, especially that have,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of religious undertone.
Right.
And a lot of the faith-based programs, not all of them, but seem to at least off the record believe in corrective rape.
Yeah.
Mm. Of some sort.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So it's disgusting.
Can you talk more about that to anyone who's listening, what that means, because maybe they won't understand what that is?
Okay, corrective rape is when you sexually assault someone because you want to change their sexual orientation. Through corrective rape. It's a form of correction. You hear about it a lot in Africa. You'll hear about corrective rape. You don't hear about it very often in the United States. There
mm-hmm.
was a radio show in Ohio, and I don't recall the name of the radio show at this point,
mm-hmm.
but I know I read it a little while back where the host actually said he supported corrective rape.
Wow.
In situations where children are, or teens are homosexual. And it's something that rarely gets said publicly,
mm-hmm.
but we've known a lot of, homosexual youth have been sexually assaulted in treatment centers, particularly faith-based ones in the United States. And I personally would never support corrective rape and think
of
it's disgusting
not.
And just an excuse for abusing people.
Mm-hmm.
And it violates every, what I would consider every Christian or decent value that you could
absolutely
have as a human being
absolutely.
To even practice or consider that as an mm-hmm. option.
Yeah, that's, I'm sorry, that is not something that should even be part of the vocabulary. We should not even know what that means. You know, it's that,
right.
That they think that that's something that's an option. When we know that rape is a horrible, dehumanizing thing to go through, and
right.
and nothing positive comes out of that in any kind
no.
of way. Wow, you know, as I'm listening to you and to Emma, you know, my heart breaks because you know the teens that are in these treatment centers are vulnerable already.
Right.
You know, these are children who already come with vulnerability, probably had trauma and abuse in their history, and now they're in an environment that seems to, the undertone is basically you have no rights, you have no power. And we know that rape and any kind of sexual assault is about power.
Exactly. And one of the things, my father is a very, what I would consider a religious nut, and he knows I feel that way about him, so it's okay for
with
me
love.
To say it.
You say
here,
it with love.
I don't even say it with love, because I have like a hate relationship with my dad most of the time. But he told me when I was younger, that I had to obey any man, whatever any man said I had to do, whether it was against the Bible or not, whether it was against morality or not, that I had to do it because men are in control and that women have to obey men no matter what, because men are the conduits to God. Women don't have a direct conduit to God. They have to go through men and that the Bible, this is the kind of stuff. And I was like, this is disgusting. My father actually worked at one of these youth facilities, but he won't tell me what one he worked for. He sent me a letter when I was in my early 20s, bragging about abusing a kid at a youth facility. And I was disgusted because I was already a survivor myself of a youth facility at that point. And I was like, oh, my God, you're sick. I don't want to have anything to do with you. So I didn't talk to him or have anything to do with him for years and years after that.
I can see why.
And I was like, you know what? You've said nasty things to me my whole life. When I was like 10 years old, he told me that he wasn't more. Told me that he wasn't more involved in my life because, quote-unquote, my mother had already ruined me. And that's when I was really little. I mean, I think I was 8 years old when he told me that. And so I felt this big rejection, and it caused all kinds of problems down the line. But then, of course, when I was 16, he said, well, he said the thing about being obedient to men, and even if they want me to, you know, if they want to rape me or do whatever they want to do to me, that I have to obey because I'm a woman and women have to obey men. And so the churches he was involved with, they run a bunch of youth programs that I'm aware of. I know he worked for one where he bragged about abusing kids there. So this is a mentality, and so I believe that they're, you know, when I hear rape victims tell me what was going on at these facilities, I had one, a number of survivors, but from a facility called New Bethany in Louisiana, which is now supposedly closed, but we don't know if they're running other facilities or working at other facilities, even though that one's closed. New Bethany, where the men would rape the girls, and then the women who worked at the program were often the wives of those men who would then beat the girls for seducing their husbands.
Oh, my God.
Wow. And so that's some of the worst, ugliest stuff we've got going these facilities.
And this is going on, people who are listening, in the United States. This is what's happening, and every day some child is getting assaulted in some form and abused. And that is terrifying. And to know that basically they're held as prisoners and forced to be in that kind of environment is really, really just mind-blowing to me. And so So I was just going to say, Angela, first of all, I want to thank you so much for the work that you do, because we need it, obviously. And your organization works very hard in helping to educate and inform and empower victims and survivors. Clearly, you know, you are very passionate about this. How did you start HEAL? I want to go into that a little bit and let people know more about what HEAL is.
Right. Well, there's a backstory. There's a long backstory and a shorter backstory, which is still really long. But
Well, do the best you can.
I'll do the best I can. Well, in 2001 or so, I was at a protest. I used to do animal rights. I was the University of Washington coordinator for the Northwest Animal Rights Network. Okay.
Fantastic.
And I was at a circus protest, an animal circus protest, where they exploit animals, like tigers and lions and bears, oh my.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I saw a tiger in a cage that was pacing, and it looked like it was in really poor condition. It did not look like a happy tiger or a healthy tiger. And it looked very distressed. And it triggered me because of my own past traumas, being in situations where I had no control and where I felt trapped. And I just really felt that this tiger was trapped and felt trapped, and like that energy was just emanating off this tiger. And I just, it triggered me from my own past of being institutionally abused and domestically abused. I mean, all of that was triggered by seeing this tiger in this condition. And so I decided to resign my position as the UW coordinator for NARN, and I really wanted to do something and go back to my roots. I mean, I'd have to go back and say, well, when I was 15, I used to volunteer for Domestically Abused Women's Network. I worked with abused children when I was 15, mm-hmm. volunteering there. And one of the children I worked with was around 2, and her abuser in her household killed her.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I had repeatedly said that we needed to get her out of that situation because she kept her injuries kept getting progressively worse, mm. and I was very scared for her. So, and I was very young. I was 15.
Sure.
So when I was telling them that she needs to get out of there, that she's going to, and then a couple of months later, it's like, well, where's this little girl? She's not showing up for the meetings. Where is her and her mother?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, she died, you know. And I'm like, she died? She died after I told you to get her out of that situation? She died, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't allow us to report it to the authorities because then the people will stop trusting Don
right.
to get help if
right.
they report it to the authorities because
mm-hmm.
they're going there hoping to get help without bringing the authorities in, or they're not ready to bring the authorities in. And I was just devastated. So I stopped working on children's issues.
I don't blame
And went
you.
Into animal rights. Yeah.
You know, it's hard. It's very difficult.
Yes. So I came back. When I had that protest, I mean, I did animal rights after that. I was
mm-hmm.
like heavy into environmentalism and animal rights, and I
mm-hmm.
still support both. And then I saw the tiger, and then the tiger triggered my abuse history and my feelings and my PTSD from everything I'd experienced. And then I was like, I have to remember these horrible things happening to children. It was like it just shot me back into
mm-hmm.
like, wait, I need to focus on children. Nobody's focusing on children.
Right.
Like I just freaked out
mm-hmm.
about it. And then I talked to some of my friends who were like also wanted to do animal welfare or animal rights, but
mm-hmm.
they didn't particularly like the heavy-handedness of some of the other animal rights groups.
Sure.
And I said, well, what if we created something where we like did everything that we care about, like human earth and animal rights, you know, or human rights and,
mm-hmm.
and environment and animal rights or whatever. What if we did something like that? And then we were like, well, what should we call ourselves if we start this new group? And then we started with the acronym HEAL because we liked that
mm-hmm.
as an acronym, H-E-A-L. And so then we were like, well, what does HEAL stand for? What are the letters? And then we went through. We actually started out with the acronym before we decided what the letters meant.
Right. No, I hear you. I've done that before.
Yeah. So we were like, okay, we want to be called HEAL. What does HEAL stand for? And I'm
right.
like, okay, well, H could be human, and then we, you know, human earth animal liberation is what it ends up standing for.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were like, well, humans first. We're going to put human rights as our first message and our most important message, and
mm-hmm.
specifically children's rights. And then specifically we were looking at institutionalized abuse
mm-hmm.
because that's where the least regulation and oversight is, and that's where some of the most egregious, if not the most egregious, abuses are occurring. I mean, the Dozier School in Florida, which was closed down
mm-hmm.
in 2011, they found over 100 children's bodies. Well, you're in Florida now, but you may have heard about this story. But there's over 100 children buried on site. Most of them are reported by the program as runaways.
Oh, wow.
One of the studies we want to see done is how many children are reported as runaways from these facilities
mm-hmm.
and how many of those so-called runaways are ever recovered or seen from or heard from again.
Right.
Because
mm-hmm.
we believe that's a common practice, is that when kids are killed in these facilities or programs, that they're being reported as runaways and never heard from again or just listed as missing persons, while in the meantime they're being buried somewhere on the program property. That facility, Dozier School, was open I think from like 1901 or something, or 1899 to 2011.
Wow.
So it was open for over 100 years.
Yeah, I think now when you're talking about it, it rings a bell. It was before I moved to Florida, but I do remember hearing about it in the news now. Terrible, 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 terrible that is occurring in our home, and people are just unaware. And I guess, like you said, I mean, it just seems like these treatment centers, there's basically all the rights are on their side, and the parents and the guardians and the children that are going there to get help have no rights. So you have mentioned before that the first thing you can do is
contact the right authorities. So for
instance,
you have mentioned if it's a therapist or a mental health provider, check to see if the facility is licensed and make sure that these are people who are qualified. Is that part
right.
of it?
Right, and if they are qualified and licensed and they're abusing people, they need to be reported to the licensing agency, and those complaints need to be filed. One of the problems is, particularly with Utah, but I think this is in other states as well, mm-hmm. is if you call Child Protective Services in Utah, they will tell you to contact law enforcement. And if you contact law enforcement will tell you to contact the licensing agency or Child Protective Services.
Right.
And then if you contact the licensing agency will say, well, you need to contact the accreditation body, which might be the Joint Commission or some other accreditation agency.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you contact the accreditation agency, because I've done all this repeatedly,
mm-hmm.
when you contact the accreditation agency, they'll say that, you know, we need to report it to the licensing agency or to law enforcement, and they send us, it's just a big runaround.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a big runaround.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, where does the buck stop? You know, where do you actually, who's going to do something about this? You know, who's mm-hmm. actually going to investigate it instead of saying, oh, well, that's not my area. You need to go here, and then mm-hmm. people keep passing the buck. One of the issues we've had with the oversight, like the licensing agencies or social services or child protective services,
mm-hmm.
is that they contract with these programs a lot of times
yes.
for kids who are mm-hmm. abused or neglected in the home or who are some in mm-hmm. the foster care system for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
They will send these kids to these programs. And if they have a contract with those facilities, they say, well, we can't, there's a conflict of interest, we can't investigate complaints against facilities with which we contract.
Huh.
And so last time I checked, and it's been a few years since I've looked to see how much money is being put into these supposed independent third-party mm-hmm. investigations, last time I checked in Utah, as prolific as their industry is, they were granting $25,000 a year for independent investigations into abuse complaints at facilities with which the state contracts.
Hmm.
So you can imagine how quickly 25 grand gets eaten up, probably
oh, yeah.
in just one investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these abuse complaints at facilities in Utah with whom the state contracts are just, well, we can't investigate, and there's no funding to investigate. Sorry.
Mm. Wow.
And that's what we get. Well, we just, you know, it's like, well, yeah, we understand it needs to be investigated, but there's no money because we've already exhausted the budget for independent investigations this year.
Now, what about the parents or the patients if the residents are able to leave, sort of like Emma, you were able to leave after a year. What legal can they sue? What can they do? I mean,
I often recommend that they sue, but if they can't afford an attorney, because mm-hmm. Often attorneys, you know, will take a low settlement
mm-hmm.
because it costs money for an attorney
sure.
to go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't afford to pay an attorney to take it to trial and you don't have a class action
mm-hmm.
or you have people who aren't willing to contribute to help get it to trial,
mm-hmm.
Then you end up taking really low settlements with non-disclosure agreements, and
then
the industry just keeps doing whatever they do, and they don't have to worry about it because now they've pretty much paid you hush money, in a sense, to keep you quiet.
Mm.
So what I usually recommend is instead of hiring an attorney, you're welcome to hire an attorney. Anyone, you know, if you
mm-hmm.
want to sue and go around that route, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
I totally support that as an option. But if you can't afford an attorney or you want to be able to have a public record that is public for sure
mm-hmm.
On this issue, contact your state attorney general and file a complaint through them as a consumer complaint and
okay.
say I was, you know, defrauded and abused at a facility and I want you to, you know, look into this. And I say your own home state's attorney general, let them be the one to contact Utah's attorney general. The
mm-hmm.
last two attorney generals in Utah before the current one, I believe Mark Shurtleff and was one of the ones that are under indictment for corruption.
Mm-hmm.
So the Utah attorney general is not who I would recommend going to. My understanding from an attorney we work with in Utah is that the current Attorney General, at least last I checked,
right,
was also currently being investigated on corruption charges. So I really just don't trust the Utah Attorney right. General's office because of all of the corruption charges that have been coming out in the last 10 years against their attorney generals. So I would say best bet is to go with your home state's attorney general if you don't live in Utah and file a complaint through them, and then let them deal with contacting the AG in Utah or whatever, because at least then, I don't know, I think that's your best shot.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad that you're able to share that with our listeners, because we wouldn't know that. You know, unfortunately, you have the experience, you know, you've worked with families who have gone through this, so we welcome that
right.
information.
And the attorney generals, I mean, they can do both civil and criminal. You know, like if they see crimes have occurred, they can then get law enforcement involved because they're the attorney general. But also if it's a consumer issue, a civil side issue, they can also help get refunds or compensation for victims in that situation. And then it also becomes a matter of public record. So
right.
I just think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Because that way, you know, for anyone that's listening, it's disclosed. So if someone in a certain facility had an investigation with the state general attorney, they can actually look it up and it'll be there. So you could see what you're getting yourself into before deciding whether or not this is a good place for your child or not.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's so important that people who are guardians and parents that are in a desperate state, just like I mentioned, that the child is suffering, is going through some issues, and the parents just want to get good help. Some of them just don't know that this is actually could happen to your child while in a treatment center. And why would you think that it would happen? I mean, it sounds like a nightmare. And even though I've heard of abuse in treatment centers in the past, this is the first time that we've dedicated an entire hour on this topic that is really, when talking to Emma and now talking to you, Angela, it's scary. You know, I don't understand why this should be an issue. Like, for instance, Emma, your situation where this person is allowed to continue to work in another facility after...
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It should right. be a non-issue. It should be like, oh, well, okay, well,
with this particular individual, I mean, when I found out about the court case, and then Angela, I saw on your site, or actually it was on your Facebook page from 2014, I think you'd set up a petition for, you know, people who'd been abused by this particular individual to please come forward. And I saw that recently, the picture came up, and I thought, oh, well, you know, if I had only seen it then, you know, I would have talked to some of the girls I knew, or, you know, saw what I could pull together, because, mm-hmm. you know, I always knew there was something off about him. But when I did find out, you know, about the rape charges, and then, you know, I looked into his history as well, and, you know, of course, I found out that he has a degree in counseling from a university that doesn't offer degrees in counseling. Like, it's mm-hmm. absurd.
Mm-hmm.
So he has, right, he's, I mean, not only is he obviously, I mean, he's, you know, he is a predator. He's also not even a licensed therapist. So the
right.
fact that he would go from one institution to the other and still be able to do the same things he's doing is shocking to me. And I did call the center that he's at now, last summer, actually, just about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they initially told me that they would look into it. You know, I didn't, and I'd asked them if they would please call me back, and they mm-hmm. didn't. So I called them back a couple weeks later, and they basically said, we're not allowed to speak to you. You know, we've looked into everything, and we're just, yeah, we're not supposed to speak to you. So, you know, in the end, it was sort of like, shame on me for, you know, trying to
taint this person's reputation or whatever, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. And so, I mean, you know, I contacted them again recently. I know he's still working there. Mm. He has a Facebook page that is public, that he writes racist, offensive posts. I mean, he's out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't seem to want to camouflage or hide himself.
Right.
So I mean, you know, it's just surprising to me that with all the evidence, including the fact that he's a therapist who doesn't actually have a degree,
mm-hmm.
You would think that all of this would lead to a dismissal but he's still practicing. Mm-hmm. And not only is he, I mean, he's practicing with women who, mm-hmm. you know, working with women who have, you know, PTSD.
Yeah, vulnerable.
Right.
Oh, that's horrible. First of all, Angela, I wanted to sort of just ask you, what is being done legislation-wise or legally, anything to protect or start getting rights for patients and their families?
Right. Well, we recently did have a victory in Alabama with HB 440. There is some disappointment because the language was changed at the last minute, but we think that even with the language change, it's still going to be effective in regulating all the faith-based and secular programs, residential programs for mm-hmm. youth in Alabama.
Okay.
And that was a win for us. I recently went in March to Washington, D.C. with Tim Brown, the Heal Kentucky coordinator,
mm-hmm.
To lobby our legislators from Washington State and Kentucky to let them know we had a big legislative request. There's a lot of things that we've asked for, but one of the things I feel would be the most imperative to improving the situation and at least getting abuse exposed better and quicker is if all staff that were direct care staff, therapists, whatever, if they were all considered by law mandated reporters,
mm-hmm.
because right now direct care staff are not considered mandated reporters, these facilities, and I think they need both the responsibilities and the protections
mm-hmm.
that are afforded to mandated reporters
mm-hmm.
so that they feel more confident. There was a lawsuit in Maine. It was a nursing home situation, and I don't remember the exact name of it. I think it had the word cove in it, but I don't want to misquote myself. I don't
mm-hmm.
have it in front of me. But there was a lawsuit in Maine. A mandated reporter who was actually a mandated reporter by law reported abuse at a nursing home facility for the elderly. And because there was a private business, and because he had in his employment contract, there was a non-disclosure confidentiality agreement, and he went to the authorities as a mandated reporter, which he's required to do so by law,
mm-hmm.
and reported the abuse he witnessed to the proper authorities. The federal district court in Maine found that his employer had the right to sue him for reporting abuse he witnessed as a mandated reporter, even though by law...
That makes no kind of sense.
Right, exactly. So what we're trying to do, one of the things we've requested that the federal government do, is say, if you're working direct care staff, if you have any kind of direct care or therapist or educator or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
if you are an adult who's working at a residential facility of serving youth or serving anyone, but in this case serving youth,
mm-hmm.
we are asking that all of those people be given the responsibilities and the protections of mandated reporters, and that there be a federal law giving mandated reporters protection from retaliation if they do report, because there are only 3 states in the country right now, to my knowledge, that even have that as a protection, where they protect mandated reporters from retaliation from their employers if they report abuse.
Hmm.
So we need that to be 50 states, not 3 states.
Do you know the states by any chance? if you know.
I think it's California and Michigan, and I can't remember what the third one is off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure California and Michigan. But the problem in California is that they do not identify direct care staff as mandated reporters.
Oh.
So a lot of the abuse is happening on the watch of direct care staff when there's no therapist or whatever on site at that point, because usually they just have psychiatrists or professionals come in once a week or whenever at a lot of these facilities where they're actually not on the premises all the time.
Right.
So a lot of this abuse is happening by other direct care staff, low-level staff, and then the staff that want to report it aren't able to because they don't have those protections.
Right.
We get tons of staff contacting us saying, I'm afraid to report because I don't want to be retaliated against. I've been threatened by the director that if I report anything that they're going to, you know, fire me or ruin my career or hurt my... I mean, some people have actually reported that they're physically afraid of violence because, like I said, some of these programs are definitely in the organized crime category, and they've actually threatened their staff with physical harm and their staff's families with physical harm.
Wow.
One whistleblower from a facility in the Midwest told me that he did not want me to reveal his name or contact information because he was taking care of an elderly relative, and he was very afraid that they would target that relative and himself physically for physical harm if it was released that he was the one who blew the whistle on what was going on. So we protected his identity. But that's the problem with survivors and anyone who's been a victim of this industry, including some of the staff, that they're terrified. These people are just horrible. Some of them are just really awful, threatening people. Like I said before, parents have been threatened with arrest. Directors have taken physical swings to hit at parents or to hit parents, threatening with arrest, actually having them arrested. I mean, like that one woman I told you about, she was actually arrested. It wasn't just a threat. They actually had her arrested and held for 24 hours. There's a lot of intimidation tactics. Right now, we're working on exposing the facility in Montana. I'm not going to go into the name of the program right now because we don't want to give them a complete heads up about what's happening. But it is in Montana, and our understanding is that in this small town in Montana, that law enforcement has been harassing the locals that are assisting us with that investigation.
Wow.
So in some cases, in some rural places in Montana and around the country, you have collusion between... And we all love that word. Collusion. Collusion between local law enforcement and the programs to cover up abuse and to prevent any kind of investigation or proper investigation, which is why a lot of the times we go to the FBI or to federal law enforcement because we don't always know if the local law enforcement is going to be trustworthy. Sometimes they are, and sometimes there's corruption involved. So it's very difficult. I know in one situation... the FBI was concerned for me because I had reported it to the local authorities first, and they had someone within the local authorities I reported to had forwarded my complaint to the facility, and they were trying to figure out who did that because they were involved in, they said that was obstruction of justice for them to have done that, and they needed to find out what agency specifically forwarded it. So that was something they were investigating I didn't even know about, but then they told me to record all my calls. Because and be very careful because these people were some really nasty players. Because the worst part of this industry is human trafficking and sex trafficking.
Yes.
That's the worst that goes on in this industry. I mean, and that includes sometimes deaths of children. Our estimate is about 292 children are killed in institutional care annually. That's HEAL's estimate, and that's based on...
I was just going to say, to interrupt, it's just that number that you just came up with, chances are it's a lot more, and that's terrifying.
Right. Because how many, like I said, how many are being reported as runaways
that
are actually, they foul play is involved,
It's like when they do statistics for rape stats, and they always say whatever the number is, and it's so much more than that, because so many victims do not tell, not even a living soul sometimes. So they just go on with their lives being torn up inside, carrying that. So it's horrible, horrible. we're actually, can you believe it, we're almost about to wrap up. And I hope that anyone that's listening, you learned something. If you're going through anything remotely like this, please contact HEAL and in your website again so that people can reach out to you.
It's www.heal-online.org. That's HEAL-ONLINE.ORG. And I would also mention that if parents are considering sending their kids away, that they really need to focus on day private schools and keep their kids at home. It's really too dangerous. There's no regulation, and you really don't know what you're getting into. Do not send your kids out of state. Don't send your kids far away from you. They need you. They need their families. They need their communities. Regardless of what kind of struggles they're having, they absolutely need the support of their loved ones, their families, their friends, their communities. And sending them away strips them of all of that and creates trauma just from that alone of abandonment issues and other risks involved with sending a child away. So it's best to keep them at home and get them outpatient treatment, day treatment, whatever you can within your own community or near you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great advice. Thank you for sharing that. Emma, again, I want to thank you for bringing this topic to my attention and being able to do this program, which I hope will help many people out there. And also, anything that you want to promote or anything that you want to share before we sign out?
Oh, I mean, no, I completely agree with everything that Angela just said. And I think, you know, for parents who, I mean, you know, for whatever reason, feel like they have to send their kids out of state. I mean, I know in my family, because I grew up in New York City, I think they wanted me to go someplace rural, which, again, I think it would have been much better just, you know, to stay in, you know, in my area. But mm-hmm. Not to send kids to or leave your kids in any treatment center where there's a rule that they can't speak to their family members without their phone calls being monitored, because, I mean, that's usually a red flag, or that usually the reason is because stuff is happening that they don't want the children to tell their parents about. So stuff that shouldn't be going on is going on. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's something I would certainly say. Or, you know, also most of these centers, I know, you know, New Haven, they have a rule where the staff is allowed to physically restrain, you know, teenagers. I would also, if you're going to send your child, your teenager, I would make sure that you send, I would not send a teenager to a place where the staff is allowed to put them in physical hold, because, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the deaths that occur because of children being restrained and, you know, injuries, you know, that could potentially be because of that. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, But, you know, in the end, yeah, I would be very wary of these places, because mm-hmm. there are, yeah, you know, some very unethical, unacceptable practices that go on. So.
Well, thank you again, Emma, for enlightening us and sharing your experience. And thank you so much, Angela, for doing what you're doing. Keep at it. We need organizations such as yourself. That I really, you've given us a lot of information, which I really, really appreciate.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having me on. What Emma just said is correct. We have a 5-point system, because they always use the point systems in these programs. So we mm-hmm. created our own 5-point system of how to identify a bad program. Mm-hmm. Holding kids incommunicado, it's also called communication blackout periods. A lot of the contracts will say there's a communication blackout period or monitored and censored calls and mail. That is what Emma just said, and people need to watch out for that. Look and see if they're licensed properly. Are they licensed and regulated and accredited properly for all of the services they claim to provide? Do they use deceptive marketing practices? Do they use restraint? Do they use isolation? Restraint and isolation are the other two that we look at. So those are the five things we look for when we're trying to decide if a program should be on our watch list.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, you know, we'll see all five light up. They're not licensed. They use restraint. They hold kids incommunicado. They put kids in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're guilty of deceptive marketing. So those are all the things to look out for. And we can definitely help anyone try to find out what's going on if they need help.
Fantastic. Again, thank you so much, ladies. And I just want to say good morning to everyone. And thank you for listening to RDF.
Like many of you, like many Americans,